Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where today we're looking at paper. Why do we love it so much? Why hasn't the digital world killed the world of paper? How do artists and galleries use it? Why do designers hold the material in such high esteem? If you're a simple, or so we think, paper merchant, what are you doing in 2017 opening a gallery cum showroom in one of the pricier parts of London?
They went to a tannery and found some hide and actually worked with the tannery and all the products they used to see how they could bring that to life in paper.
And Neil Whittington, head honcho of Stationers and Designers Present and Correct, will tell us why it's only ever been paper for him.
When I was little, I had like a toy post office and I loved the tax disc with all the perforations and all the forms were really nice. And, you know, I was just surrounded by card and paper and they were my toys.
Paper and all its glory then, that's Culture with me, Robert Bound, right here on Monocle 24. First of all, on this voyage into the pulped stuff, let's speak to a man whose company, Present and Correct, has been at the vanguard of this renewed love for paper. Renewed? Well, yes. A decade ago, we were told that paper was a thing of the past, that backlit screens were the way to absorb information, and that you'd be mad to start a business selling interesting stationery. But is he mad? Is Neil Whittington nuts? Not a bit of it. A former designer at Monocle's sister company, Wink Creative, Neil set up Present and Correct to mesmerise with its online offerings of beautifully designed stationery and beguile with his lovely shop in North London that embodies the benefits of putting pen to paper, whatever the results. Neil Whittington, founder of Present and Correct, dropped by Midori House.
I started it, I think it was 2008. So it's a long time ago. It was
they
just
are
online.
Mists of time that we're peering through.
Yeah, it was ages ago. And it was just online and it was just a place for me to sell my designs as and when I made them.
Yeah.
And a place to showcase my collection and the things I find and the things I like. And it's such a basic premise and that's all it ever was. Just kind of stationery and office ephemera. General paper, ephemera and stamps. It's just my taste.
Presented in this Present and Correct way. Presented in an orderly, attractive, photogenic style.
A style which I think has become heightened over the years, just inevitably because you get a sense of what people like and how they respond to it and that you kind of fine-tune it, I suppose. Hopefully not too contrived. But again, the way I present stuff is just how I like something to look.
Yeah.
And I think that the look of it has become more popular. It's a thing now, like knolling and flat lay. It's a thing, but it's quite a retro thing as well.
Before we get into the crux of our conversation, which will be about paper, tell us about knolling and flat lay. These are two things that I know people will write in and go, hang on, you had Neil Whittington come in and talk about this as if we knew what those things meant. So talk us through those.
So knolling is arranging things at right angles to one another.
Yeah.
That's it. Basically, just making something look neat.
So where does the word come from?
I actually don't know. I don't know whether it's related to Knoll, as in
the furniture company.
I don't really know the history of the word. I think it's quite a recent thing.
You sound like you're saying it with a K on the... A K. Silent K.
Yes. Yeah. But it's a big thing online. It's just, I guess it's a trend. It's just a visual style that a lot of people are doing. And then flat lay is something that Monocle knows about. It was used, I think, in the 60s and 70s, and just that kind of perfect aerial shot of items laid out neatly. It's all over the internet. It's all over Instagram. Yeah. There are Tumblrs dedicated to it. Tumblrs dedicated to knolling. There are books about it now.
And talking of Tumblr, and you have a wonderful, clean and pristine and very direct social media presence. We'll talk about that later. But let's talk about your love of paper, first of all, because I presume that's part and parcel of where the company and where the branding of the company comes from.
Yeah.
Now, we worked together many moons ago upstairs at Wink Creative here, which was, you know, has a similar DNA, obviously, to Monocle. There's a lot of paper. There's a lot of little blue plasters floating around, paper cuts, possibly. So talk us through maybe some of your early memories of paper, what it meant to you and what it means to you now.
Well, I think as a designer, that kind of dictates a love of paper in a way. And from someone who's always drawn, if you've always drawn and enjoyed making things, then you grow up with paper and that kind of craft sensibility. So yeah, when I was little, I had like a toy post office and I had stamps.
I had one of those.
Yeah, they were amazing. Yeah. And I loved the tax disc with all the perforations and all the forms were really nice. Yeah. And, you know, I was just surrounded by card and paper and they were my toys. And I think if you become a graphic designer or you want to do those things, it's just like an inherent part of the job. You automatically have that desire for paper and for print and for finishes. Like all graphic designers love foiling
love
embossing,
or
those things that graphic designers fantasize about doing don't always get the chance to, but all those things are just part of that kind of dream world of design, I think.
I wanted to ask you about paper's role in a world that we're often told is digital, and a lot of the news that we receive, a lot of the chats with our friends are done through smartphones and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But also, as we've talked about before, you're popular on social media, you're great on social media, but you do it to promote your business,
yeah.
But you also do it to promote something that is ineffably lo-fi and manual and analog, which is paper. Do you see a kind of discussion, do you see a tension between the digital world and the paper world?
Well, I think for the social media side of things, any small business should get involved with that. I know that everyone doesn't enjoy it, but it is very useful for driving audiences and sales and communicating with people. If you're a small business and you don't have the budget for PR, but also it can strengthen a brand because it's so visually based these days. I think Twitter's good, but Instagram is the biggest one. People just want images and they want to see nice things. And I think that's the bottom line. It's really shallow and fickle and people forget in half an hour. But people are driven by those photos and then people emulate those photos. And it goes back to the flat line, the nolling. And people like to have objects to put on their own Instagram and style it in a certain way. Social media is kind of pushing that desire for things. And I think that books and print and paper are part of that, definitely.
Yeah, it is a funny thing that, and you're pushing people in the direction to buy things from present, not buy necessarily things from present, but appreciate the attitude and the style with which you show your products or just other things that you like. There are a lot of things that live in your universe that aren't your own things, aren't
it's
there?
Just communicating what you appreciate, I suppose. And the bottom line is you're pushing your taste and saying, this is what I like. This is a really nice wall or a tile or I love this spine, you know, book spine, obviously.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a whole host of things and it's enjoyable. And I think people get pleasure from it as well.
Do you think, this is a pretty basic question, but this is something that this program is going to be about, is people's appreciation of paper is something that is very contemporary, or do you think it is something that's nostalgic?
I think it's a bit of both. I think that the nostalgia obviously comes from, but then maybe that's a generational thing. Because we're of an era where at school we had notebooks and it was kind of quite old-fashioned compared to nowadays, I suppose. So there is that kind of nostalgia. But I think the recent rise in stationery and the desire for paper is also to do with people getting bored of doing everything on screens. And I think we kind of naturally want to come back to tactile and sensory things. We are sensory animals and we have that, you know, we have fingers and we like textures and probably going to get more pleasure from that than from swiping on screen all the time, which is always going to be constantly smooth and shiny. And so I think there's a desire for that. And I think that humans automatically come back around to what kind of wanting the opposite of what is popular. I just think that happens. It's just like a natural thing.
Do you feel that as a graphic designer, the artistry of that, that something like paper holds you to ransom a bit more? It makes you more honest because, sure, you can rub something out with an eraser, but it's not as simple as just clicking undo on a tablet or on your phone or on your big screen designer's computer, right? There is something where you have to think about the line that you're going to draw or the word you're going to write on paper that is different to that when it's committed to a digital format.
Yeah, and it's quite nice to see errors and to see the way that your thought has changed. And, you know, when you're doing sketches, you always encourage when you sketch that you shouldn't rub out all the time because that's part of the process and I suppose becoming less precious with it. And I think it's quite nice not to be too precious about paper when you're making lists, and it's just how it is. It's the nature of it, I suppose.
Okay, so you've mentioned making lists. I'm glad you did that because I do want to know, from someone from such an august paper-based business, Neil, let's run through a few things. Let's talk about the more ordinary, mundane end of things. Notes to the milkman, or whatever people do these days. What do they go on in the Whittington household?
Post-it notes.
Okay, that's a post-it
and
note.
Just torn out bits of paper.
Okay.
Just, I always have a notebook in my bag.
And what sort of breed is the notebook?
It's quite a standard.
Yeah.
The notebooks that I use, they get kind of quite a rough treatment because they're in my bag and they get thrown around. And they are just for thoughts and lists and leaving notes for people or sticking a note on the shop door or whatever. They're not especially fancy.
They're not fancy.
No, because I quite like fancier notebooks to sit around and look pretty rather than to be used, which is maybe a bit controversial. But then I think that comes back to being a designer. And I think also, like reading books now, they've become quite fetishized. You know, in Waterstones now, there is a section just called Beautiful Books.
Yeah.
And it's the content's almost irrelevant. It is about just them looking lovely and people wanting to display them. And I suppose because so many people went online for reading and Kindles, etc., that they had to kind of push that desire a little bit more and get people back to buying the actual object. It's the same with stationery as well. There are so many more companies making interesting stationery now. It's become a lot more trend-based, and there are furniture companies doing stationery and notebooks and folders and office supplies, and I think that's quite interesting, and maybe like 5 years ago that didn't really exist.
So this is the object, right? This is very much about that, as holding something in your hands, the pleasure of ownership of something.
And I think it comes back to organising as well, and the organising is such a thing at the moment. It's, you know, kind of making your life feel kind of a bit more settled and a bit more ready and good to go.
Do you find that at the beginning of the year, people want to start the year with a couple of handsome notebooks? They literally, metaphorically, want a blank piece of paper to start with on the 1st of January.
Yeah, and I think the same with diaries as well.
Yeah.
I sell more diaries every year. I always order more and they always all go. And people still, you know, they come in March and April deciding that they needed one and they regret not getting one. And I think that's interesting. And also, most of my customers are kind of, I would say, like early 20s to mid 30s. So these people are buying diaries. They're not doing everything on their phones. And that's nice, heartening.
And there is something about the diary that is, again, along with the blank sheet of paper, of whatever size and quality it is the idea of intention.
Yes.
And there is the idea of good intention, I suppose.
And also the physicality of it. I don't use my phone for the calendar or the diary, but you can't, it's not the same flicking through that as it is flicking through pages. And it's not as easy to see everything in one place, I find.
You possibly don't get the same sense of time passing or how
far
away you are from something in June.
Yeah, a week or a month. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It doesn't seem real somehow.
And in terms of present and correct, people will listen to this and they'll know to head off to your website. It's a beautiful thing in itself. And the shop,
you,
which is just around the corner from Whittington Towers, I suppose.
Yeah, right? It is. It's
You're on Arlington Street.
Yeah, Arlington Way, yeah. Arlington Net Way. Angel, EC1.
And what are the best performing lines? And are they the lines that you expect people to want to buy, actually?
Well, it changes quite a lot. And I don't just sell paper. So at the moment, I've got these kind of crazy scissors from Japan that were designed in the 80s and they've been reissued and they're really popular. The really popular items are always driven by Instagram. Things like that get shared quite a lot. And if they're things that people haven't seen anywhere else, which I really strive to get products that aren't all over the place. That's the other downside about the internet and social media, is that there's so many overlaps with other companies and it's a lot harder to find things that other people don't have. But it's worth it if you can.
Okay, so we're veering into the realm of the digital. Let's get back to paper.
Sorry.
Before we kiss you goodbye, Neil. I was fascinated by you sort of saying, I had a toy post office when I was a kid and I loved the perforation, the detail, the weight of the paper, the feel of it, the smell of it and all the rest of it. What's the best bit about paper for you? When I unwrap, I get sent lots of books here, you know, novels and things, and I love the smell of them. I know, when you open the envelope, the envelope's not
Did
very
you know
nice
only,
place.
Only,
the book itself is.
Yeah, but only books made out of plant-based paper smell good. They smell
right?
the best.
Okay.
Because plant-based paper breaks down and releases vanillin and an almond-type smell as well. That's why old books smell
good. We're marvelling at the degradation of
Yeah, the rotting of the paper.
Okay. The noble rot.
But that's why old books smell better.
Yeah.
Because the paper's generally plant-based and the glue's different.
At the moment, what is your favourite paper experience? Is it scratching about in your rough book? Is it doodling while you're on the phone?
I think it's scratch cards. Lottery scratch cards are the best.
I think that is the perfect place on which to end. Paper, power to it. My very great thanks to Neil Whittington.
Thank you,
President Incorrect. Thank you for coming in. Off to Singapore then, where STPI Creative Workshop and Gallery has a unique focus on the use of paper to make experimental contemporary art. And it's breaking the mould of Southeast Asian contemporary art institutions in doing so. Packaged with its very own paper mill, large gallery space and residence units, it's an enviable centre for collaborations that's creating new generations, carrying on the traditions of papermaking and also expanding the public's view of the use of paper beyond simple prints. From its unlikely city centre, Riverside premises, here's the STPI's director, Emmy Yu, and she's telling us how.
Well, it's kind of ironic to have a paper mill situated in Singapore where humidity rate at times can go up to almost 99%. So I think that was one thing that a lot of public just thought, like, why have papermaking place in Singapore? The artworks on paper here in this climate is almost like a killer, right? But paper is one of the most amazing inventions in our civilization, as I think all would agree. It has always been used as a supporting medium, I think, especially in the arts. But here at SDPI, paper becomes the protagonist. It is the one that actually is centered around and dictates how the work is made. And the way we use the paper is really kind of diverse, and it has it's one spectrum to another. So basically, we use paper as much as we can in as many ways we can possibly use. The possibilities are infinite. Of course, we have to, once we make the paper, we have to make sure that it doesn't get wet. I mean, that is the most challenging part. And we are actually always talking about how can we make non-molding paper, non-molding, I don't know if you have the word for that, something that can preserve for many, many centuries to come, like papyrus, you know? So that is something that we are constantly trying to do some research when we have time. But yeah, I mean, it's used in so many various ways.
How has SDPI helped to develop an appreciation of paper in its programs so far?
Yes, I think just going back when we started, people just kind of dismissed us because, oh, you know, you cannot collect works on paper because it gets moldy, and then, you know, I have to bring it to the conservators to wash. And back then, the arts ecosystem in Singapore is not as what we have now, and we have a pretty good ecosystem here from the service providers such as conservators and the framers as well. So I think what SDPI really single-handedly did for, I mean, if I can speak for Singapore, is to where we contributed in fostering and engendering collector base who would be collecting works on paper a lot more than before. And also we helped to contribute towards the growth of different industries like framing, proper framing, the museum archival framing, and also the conservation side of the paper. But at the same time, we also kind of grew up together with the art handlers, notably Helu Trans, who've been our partner since day one. I remember they also started really very small, two people in the team, and now it's like, I don't know, I'm sure their team is as large as ours. So I think this is what SDPI contributed, and at the same time, it kind of, through our activities, and especially bringing artists from around the world, and then having very, very consistent exhibition programming, I think that really helped foster understanding of this whole kind of a contemporary art exhibition realm, I guess, if you want to say it, and also with the museums. And now we have the National Gallery and Singapore Museum continuously putting up Singapore Biennial. And I think slowly we have kind of contributed in a small way to play our part, which connects to the private sector as well as public sector, because we are part of the visual arts group together with Singapore Art Museum and National Gallery. So there are many things. And now with our SDPI gallery is extremely active internationally, participating in all three Art Basel fairs. So with that, our gallery does its part in really kind of growing their database and reaching out to all the collectors, not only in Singapore and the region, but internationally. And in this time of globalization and Singapore attracting so many visitors from Europe and America, when they come to Singapore, they inevitably come to see SDPI because they have seen us in the fairs abroad. But at the same time, they get to learn about what other galleries there are in Singapore, as well as what kind of other arts are being offered. So I think it took some time, but I mean, you know, you'd rather take some time to make a good foundation rather than to build something very quickly without a sound base. Mm-hmm. So I think we're on the right track.
Wonderful. Maybe just one last question. I was wondering, what are the sort of resources that has enabled SDPI to do and contribute this amazing breadth of things that you've done with the Singapore art scene that maybe other galleries can't?
Well, we're very fortunate to have the support of the ministry. They have always been very, very supportive. And I think I have to thank really the founding fathers of our STPI who had the idea and vision to think that this place could contribute to fostering and engendering the arts professionals all the way around, from the practitioners, our paper makers and printers, to the administrative professionals in the gallery. So without their help, I don't think we would be here. It had been a kind of an uphill battle, but we have come thus far, I think, because our team, and that's what I would like to say, is that a lot of people come to our visit STPI and they see this really amazing 1,100 square meter space of workshop with a great monumental presses and the facility that we have, and they're just so impressed. We have a beautiful artist studio, and also this building houses four different apartments for artists to stay. But actually, at the end of the day, what made STPI come thus far, 15 years and still more to come, is really the people who have dedicated their time and life and their passion to making this, our program, so sustainable and so attractive. And most notably, the people in the workshop who are working very, very closely with the artists. And I think artists are the most important element in this equation. And if we don't have artists, we cannot sustain our program. And artists are always willing to come back, and they really appreciate what we do because our people in the workshop, and they're such key and very, very vital resource that we have in STPI. And of course, together with them, if we cannot execute a good exhibition, because there's like a follow-up on the other side of the equation is the gallery, where they strive to maintain the excellent standard of practice in presenting the works the way it should be and preparing the scholarly catalog that is going to be read by everyone around the world. So we try to maintain that balance, and it's really the people. Without them, I don't think we could do. But we do need artists. They are the most important element in this.
That was Zayana Zulkifli reporting from the wonderful STPI in Singapore. Emmy Yu can come on our show and talk about anything she'd like, as far as we're concerned. Now we've got time just to squeeze in a quick visit to an unusual place a stone's throw or two away from Monocle's HQ in London. The papermaker G.F. Smith has a long history. It was founded in 1885 by George Frederick Smith and supplies many a magazine and artist with their raw materials. In December, they opened a new showroom in London, showcasing their work and its beautiful colour palette. Among some examples of their collaborations with brands such as Mulberry, visitors can also see special installations in the basement, which at the moment are rolls of colourful paper imitating the undulations of the ocean. Is it a gallery? Is it a paper shop? G.F. Smith's Director of Business Development, Margaret Sweeney, spoke to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco at the showroom.
Our window display is entitled Turbulence, and what it does is it takes you from one end of the colour spectrum straight through to the other. So it starts at white and it ends at black. This is also very relevant to our colour cycle and our colour making. We make special colours on a weekly basis. There's four cycles, and this is all relevant to the colour cycle within the window display. So it's really important for the brands to be able to see this at first glance and know what week each colour is being made. So our first collaboration in our space, this is our open space area here, and it's all about the bespoke story. I've worked with Mulberry for the last 20 years, and I've worked on the last three rebrands they've had. This one started this time last year. We took Jack Foreman from Mulberry to the mill, and we worked with him and the whole creative team at Mulberry on developing their own bespoke range of colour. It was when Johnny Coco became creative director, he wanted to take the brand back to its roots. So he was so inspired by the greenery, which pictured the whole factory in Chilcompton, that he wanted to go down the green route. But Johnny didn't want to take it down a cold, cold green. He wanted a nice, warm, bluey green. So this was probably one of the most technically challenging products I've ever worked on. And it literally got to the stage where we had saturated the fibres to the max, that we couldn't actually put any more dye on the fibres So after making the special colour for Johnny, he then decided he wanted a texture that looked like the leather of the bags. So he supplied us with a piece of hide from the iconic British Bayswater and asked us to match it to the paper. So if you look at the packaging display here, which the team produced, and it's quite beautiful, I'm sure you'll agree, you've got the special bluey green, but you've also got their bespoke texture, which looks like the leather. So this is a really, really beautiful bespoke piece just to the brand.
I'm sure you have a lot of clients coming in as well, but do you have like the odd people who is walking on the street and wonder, what is this? I just want to find out.
The last 3 months has just been totally VIP clients. It's our actual clients that we've worked with for years, just letting them see the space and understand how it works so that they can take their clients here to embrace what we do.
What other clients do you guys have? Can you just give me an idea besides Mulberry?
Yeah, we work with Burberry, we work with Mulberry, we work with Stella McCartney, we work with nearly every graphic design studio within the UK. We work with printers, we work with merchants. To be honest, there's not one creative sector within the UK and now globally that we don't work with.
That's fascinating. Shall we walk through in the...
Yeah.
I have to say, they're very distracting, this colour plan. There's so many beautiful colours. We're just behind chameleon and orange here. It's yeah.
No, it is fantastic. And a lot of our ranges have really special, unique ingredients. Some has cement, some has gold leaf, some has beer.
Oh, so they have different textures.
Let
me touch chameleon here. 1 second.
Yeah. The chameleon, this was all made by our mill, and they spent 2 years producing this. And what they did was they went to a tannery and found some hide and actually worked with the tannery and all the products they used to see how they could bring that to life in paper. So downstairs is our show space. So I'll just show you.
Wow.
So here we let the paper talk for itself. The exhibition is called Tidal. We showcased it in Jaipur at the end of last year, but it was so successful, we decided to open up our show space here in London with the same exhibition. And I think the exhibition speaks for itself. It's just an array of every single colour within the colour plan range. And I think it's quite phenomenal, really.
And that was GF Smith's Margaret Sweeney. Maybe check out worldsfavouritecolour.com to choose your favourite shade. And that brings us skidding to a halt at the end of a show all about the enduring appeal of paper, the material, the civilising force for good, the thing you carry in your pocket if you're a good student, the most fundamental, malleable, useful thing we've ever invented as a human race, except the spork, obviously. Only joking. You've been listening to Culture, where my producers were Holly Fisher and Bill Lutie. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds, and thank you very much for tuning in.